That's okay. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about is stuff that initially came out last year, but there's a sequence of two or three papers in the mill at the moment, which should come out sometime this month, with various permutations of these authors. I want to start with talking though a little bit about the origins of the problem. And there's an old Roger Zelazny story about a time long ago when the devil tried to kill off all the philosophers and alchemists and or anybody who thought for a living. And the way he chose to do this was to send or think up lots and lots of problems, very engaging problems, and he'd send them out into the world, and thereby the thinkers would think about the problems to the exclusion of all else. They'd become completely self-absorbed and just disappear into themselves, decouple, and die. And to do this, he got his demons and he told them the problems and sent them forth. This problem has that such an origin. It didn't kill me, but I know who the demon was. He's sitting there. I'm glad you came. Anyway, the origin of the problem is something in holographic flows, and I'll say something about that as we go. But really, it's about generally about supersymmetric backgrounds and how you make them. And in that context, I want to talk about some of the progress we've been making. But to do that, I want to talk about sort of a little brief review, sort of oriented in the right way, of older stuff, or how you look at supersymmetric backgrounds in terms of special harmonic rules and that kind of thing. The sort of new developments, or relatively newer developments in this, are talking about so-called spinner prescriptions. I'll say a lot more about that later. And also, closely related is this whole subject of G structures, about which I'll say very little. The key to solving the original problem I came to is algebraic killing spinners, which I will actually define, and basically the understanding of how to solve this class of problems.
Sure.
Where, I couldn't find the knot. This? This.
Higher. Lower.
Oh, I see. It's carefully hidden. Oh, much better. Thank you. Right. Where's my eyes? Okay. So basically, what I'm really looking for are how to characterize the supersymmetry in sort of flow solutions with black Coulomb branches. So classic, in fact, the n equals 2 one was the motivation, but there are quite a few of these out there. And there are two parts of this which are going to enable us to make a spin around that's and actually solve the problem in rather more generality than had been done before. One of which is that because you've got some fluxes, the brains you started with get dielectrically polarized, and the question is how to handle that in making or figuring out what the supersymmetries are. And the second key to finding the supersymmetries is to actually make heavy use of what the brain probe moduli space looks like. And so I'll sort of outline the major part of the talk, what the basic idea is, and then go on through an example, and then if there's time, talk about where you might take this and what you can do with it. Okay, so the origins of the problem. So basically, it goes way back to looking at holographic flows in n equals 4 Yang-Mills theory. And so in n equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, you can write it in terms of n equals 1 multiplets. That's, of course, vector multiplet and 3 chiral multiplets, and you can muck around with them. First and most obvious thing to do, which preserves a fair bit of supersymmetry, is to make a mass, turn on a mass for the hypermultiplet. And when you do that, you have a Coulomb branch, which is one complex dimensional in terms of looking at the possible VEVs of this. And then there is a Dernier-Witten effective action, which is well known, which you can get the gauge couplings and so forth entirely in terms of the obvious gauge invariance on the Coulomb branch. The brain description is the basically that you're looking at the holographic description of that flow is, of course, D3 brains. And when you go out in the Coulomb branch, they start spreading out in the phi-3 direction. And you can send probes in from the side from phi-3, in the phi-3 direction, there's a one-dimensional complex dimensional moduli space that you can use to study this thing. And of course, in large N, the way this gets described is that the D3 brains can spread out with some arbitrary density functional in this direction, and it should be freely choosable. That's what it means to say you've got some freely choosable set of VEVs. You can think of it, if you like, the choice you have up here in the U1 through the UN encodes the same information as this density function. And as I said, my personal demon with the J on it is to ask exactly how to characterize this holographically. How is the supersymmetry work in this case?
I think it's co-demons.
Yeah, but There was, but you know, it was sort of exactly targeted. It didn't cause me to waste away and die, but it was one of those problems that sort of keeps nagging at you, and well, did for me. So it was well tailored. It just kept coming back and sort of nibbling. So anyway, there's a variation, which is the example I'm going to talk on by the end of today, which is if you take an n equals 1 supersymmetric flow, where you just turn on a single mass, one of the chiral multiplets, and then you have a flow to a fixed point field theory, but all along that flow, and at the fixed point, there is a Coulomb branch, two complex dimensional Coulomb branch, in the sense of you can give BEVs to the remaining mass of scalars. And in fact, even at the fixed point, you can check this particularly explicitly has the appropriate dimension to be the marginal operator or a marginal operator. There are lots more. But anyway, you have a two-dimensional complex Coulomb branch. And in principle, this guy has a, again, a freely choosable brain density. I think I've got an extra bar in there, but freely choosable brain density with the brain spreading out in any direction. You should be able to choose this and find the solution. And there are further generalizations of this whole idea. Once you've got down to this one, you can also talk about n equals 2 quiver theories, some generalized Klebanov-Witten flows. They all sort of fall into this class of issues. And in fact, there's all sorts of interesting conjectured duality associated with families of fixed point flows originating from such n equals 2 quiver theories. And I think Nick Almaghi talked here on Tuesday about this. Again, the issue is, what is the holographic description of this? And there's a fairly large class of problems. I've added at the bottom a comment. Every one of these stories, one of these flows, has an M3 analog. You can get the M3 analog story by just simply taking the D3 brains, wrapping them up on a circle, T-dualizing, you get D2 in 2A, and you can lift to M3. This is useful as a computational tool. The field theory, well, the field theory on the M brain is perhaps more difficult to handle or understand from a field theory point of view, but in terms of supergravity, it's a useful tool to actually try and solve problems to go to the M3 analog. Now, the whole point is to get away from gauge supergravity, and so there's not going to be an orgy of gauge supergravity. But I need to say what we know and what we're going to try and get at from the solution. So, you can muck around with gauge supergravity in 4 and 5 dimensions. It's a powerful computational tool with huge limitations. You can get a one-parameter family of solutions to both of these classes of flows, the first one, which is n equals 2, and the second one, which is n equals 1, Lee Strassler. But you can get a two-parameter family to the latter. And those have been known for quite some time, about 4 years. The brain probe, you can analyze the solutions by brain probe analysis. You can send brain probes. This was done by a bunch of people here. And I think it was in the context of that was the demonic laughter in my ear that I heard said about this. So anyway, still with me. Brain spread basically can spread in uniform distribution in this case. In other words, you've got the gauge supergravity's limitation is that you're dealing with the lowest harmonics, usually in the higher dimensional theory, so the brains have as uniform a distribution as you can think of. And the parameters involved are really just the radius of the distribution and not much else, or occasionally radii if you're spreading in two directions. The thing that's simple, the thing that gauge supergravity buys you in this story is that they are characterized by ridiculously simple flows. Or ridiculously simple sets of equations. And the n equals 2 flow is characterized by steepest descent on a rather simple potential. This is roughly the fermion mass, and this is roughly the spreading of the brains. You can spread the brains in two directions and keep n equals 1. It's not much more difficult. So the point is, the complete solution, everything about this flow, is characterized by ridiculously simple equations. And that's the thing you really want to try and focus on. And as I say, when you build it up, we'll talk about that in a second, it looks more complicated. So there are two important facts, another important fact you need to draw from this. These equations come from the supersymmetry variations. They're first order, so if you solve equations of motion, you get second order, and generically they get a lot harder to solve, and that really is going to come out very strongly later. The key is to keep your eye on that one. That's where you see the easiest way to do it. Now, the second part of this story is, in fact, it's called uplifting, but it isn't very uplifting. It's very complicated and nasty. So basically, this is the art, art, science, it's a combination of both, of taking those gauge supergravity solutions and pushing them up into their parent dimension so you can try and think of them as string compactification. And I'm focusing here on 2B, But basically, this is just to impress you of the complexity of the solution in general. You have D3 brains, which means you turn on this gauge field. You have a fermion mass term, which means you're turning on two form gauge fields. You typically have running couplings, although in some examples you don't, so you have dilaton and axion backgrounds. And all of this, of course, feeds into the metric, but you also have additional metric deformations since you're trying to get a Coulomb branch. So you're looking for an extremely complex family of solutions. You can make a modest simplification. The M-theory analogs push it all into a three form, but you still have to look at multiple independent components of that form. And the other side of the way M-theory is also useful is there's a lot more known about what are called the G-structures, which is actually a useful thing to know. Less is known because people haven't done it yet for 2B. So I guess the statement for the M-theory analogs is that this is a useful way to get at these things, to try and see what's going on. It's not a huge simplification. But the bottom line is, the unpleasant fact is that you're looking for something that's a very, very complex combination of fluxes and metrics. It should be simple intrinsically because it's supersymmetric. And so there should be some underlying simple equations, but the end result is going to be complicated. But you're trying to find the simplest possible description of it. Now, to sort of set the stage, I want to remind you, this is probably the last place on Earth I need to talk about this, but I want to remind you of some facts about, in some sense, this is the paradigm of what you want to do. If you're looking for supersymmetric solutions which involve Coulomb branches, you want to learn as much as you can from the simplest possible case first, and see if you can find the general threads. So in this case, I'm going to look at the Coulomb branch where you haven't broken anything, you haven't turned on any masses. And then, of course, one knows if the brain's in this direction and the transverse dimensions are labeled by y's, we know very well how to deal with the problem. You just take in the density, you solve the appropriate harmonic equation with the source by that density of brains, and then you get a metric solution expressed entirely in terms of the harmonic function, some warp factor in front of the thing parallel to the brain, some warp factor in front of the transverse guy, with some powers alpha, beta, and gamma turning up in front of the electric p-form field. Now, perhaps what's tad less well known is how you build the killing spinners, but it's very, very trivial once you have this. But this is the thing you want to model and generalize. First of all, there's the sort of standard projector. Depending on the reality properties, there's a power of I there. And you basically say, I want to find the spinners that, first of all, that are constant, don't depend on anything, but have a projection condition appropriate to the brains. Then it turns out that the killing spinners are given by taking an appropriate power of that thing, the quartet power, and simply multiplying by constant spinners, and you're done. It's very, very easy to build the killing spinners. You write a projector with constant spinners, and then this scale turns up in front of the constant spinners. The reason why this is very, very easy to understand. It is a fact, which is phenomenally useful in this game, that no matter how complex the background, it is always, always true, at least in 2B and M theory, that if you construct the obvious sandwich, that is always a killing vector. It's always a symmetry. And if these two spinners are made the same in the right way, it is typically a time-like or null killing vector. In this case, it'll be time-like. And it's parallel to the brain. And so therefore, you can simply normalize this by saying, well, this is parallel to the brain. This must be actually a constant component vector. And therefore, it's not a surprise that this thing gets normalized by, in fact, the quartet power of whatever's up there. But this is a very useful thing. But the philosophy is what I want to get at. You nail the spinner by running down a projector, and you normalize it using the killing property. Putting all down in supersymmetry terms, what you're saying is that commutator of two supersymmetries must be a translation in the Poincaré direction, and you use that fact to normalize everything. Now, the second extremely well-known story is special holonomy. But again, I want to pull some general truths out of this. So in special holonomy, what you're doing, you've got no flux, or maybe you've got a little bit of flux, but you can think of it as a torsion, and you're trying to solve covariant constancy of the spinner. And this leads you to so-called special holonomy, where the connections are nice and so forth, and the mathematicians have largely classified it for us. I want to focus particularly, since it's relevant to what I'm going to do, onto the Kähler case and remind you again about how you build the spinners. So in this case, you've got some SO2N holonomy generically, but it's specialized to SUN cross U1. I'm not going to assume Ricci flat. All I want is Kähler. And if you're doing n equals 1 supersymmetry, you don't want a whole n's worth of them. You only want one of them, and so therefore you basically have to have the SUN singlets. And there's a standard algorithm for isolating those spinners. It's extremely straightforward. You write a metric. Well, first of all, you've got a complex structure. You use it. And you write the metric in frame pairs, paired in an obvious block diagonal way so that you represent, this is the imaginary partner of that real part. And then what you do is, having chosen your frames, you, of course, set up your gamma matrices. And there are helicity projectors, which basically project you on all the spin ups and spin downs in all of these directions. And then the SUN singlets are given by the guys, these projection, helicity projectors, where all the spins are up or all the spins are down. And those are the SUN singlets. Standard procedure. But again, what I'm hammering here is the way to think about these spinners is always take whatever little geometry you've got and build projectors. And here you build the projectors straight out of the complex structure. So these are the sort of two themes that I want to preserve. One of which is that you basically build projectors and then you use the killing structure to normalize everything inside. Okay, now onto the general problem. So this is now. So I'm using essentially the Nork conventions. Actually, I think I flipped my fonts. Gamma, capital, there's no difference in capital and lowercase gammas. I'm using John Schwartz's description of 2B supergravity. But basically, what you're trying to solve is this class of equations, where you have buried in here, actually, a dilaton connection, axionic connection, and five-form and a three-form flux in general. And also, the thing that just makes life miserable is that you have the spinner and its complex conjugate, so it makes life a bit more painful, particularly if you're trying to use mathematics. And similarly, this thing is the kinetic term for the scalar and three-form field. You're trying to solve these. Now, the very first thing you do, which is, in fact, in Granov-Baczynski, the very first thing you do is you say, look, I've got Poincaré invariants on the brain. So there's an obvious 4 plus 6 split. So here's the 4 component, the space-time spinner and its complex conjugate. You give it a helicity, it has a particular helicity on the 4 dimensions, and then this has to have the opposite helicity so that you basically preserve the gamma 11 helicity in the 10-dimensional space. So you immediately break this up, and the question you are really asking is, what are the possibilities for relating this guy to this guy? How is chi1 related to chi2? And depending on, you know, what you're trying to focus on, you start doing the best you possibly can. The first thing you can do, in fact, is you say this is zero. It's called type B, I think, in your classification, right? So you say it's zero. Another thing you could do is you can say, oh, it's simply related by a phase where the phase is constant. I think Andy Frey is now talking about situations where this is now a function. So you try and do something that's manageable computationally. But the trouble is, the solutions that I was looking for, the ones that are known holographic flows, do not fit into this scheme, and they don't seem to fit into anybody else's scheme. What's happened to my transparencies? I think there's... So anyway, the issue you're having to deal with is you've got much more complicated functional relationships between this guy and this guy. This is a good start, and it gives you some very interesting solutions involving imaginary self-dual Gs and things like this, but it doesn't cover the cases that I want to cover. And those cases are, I should stress, motivated by physically important holographic flows. They are not something I've just invented to keep myself amused, or the devil has invented to keep me amused. They are actually real, honest, interesting physical flows. And so finally, last year, after much nagging in the back of my brain, I decided to pick one of these holographic flows and analyze the hell out of it. Just take it apart and figure out exactly what the supersymmetries look like. And it gave us a very useful insight, which led us to this whole business of algebraic killing spinners. So let me make a summary of what I'm trying to accomplish, or what we said so far, the sort of general lessons, and then we'll get to the details, or more of the details. The full supersymmetry solution you're looking for is going to be complicated. The metric's going to be a mess. If you looked at these things, I think Chris Pope called the functions that appear in them typically dog's breakfast functions. I think that's not terrible. I think it's not very charitable, but it's probably true. Full supergravity solution will be complicated, but the whole point is you should find a simple set of equations that drives it. The structure of the solutions, since you're turning on a mass, and the mass is the most relevant parameter of the fermions, that whole solution should be determined by the running and the flow of that holographic mass term. So this simple set of equations should have everything to do with that mass term. There should be a freedom. You should be able to take the Coulomb branch of the distribution of the brains. The sort of goal you want is to try and generalize this harmonic rule by this simple set of equations. And just as more as a comment, the term that goes around this kind of class of problems is trying to solve the weak holonomy, or solve that problem. Weak holonomy is just another word for solving the complicated problem I've outlined, but the idea is to try and put flesh on this idea of generalizing holonomy. The other message is work from the supersymmetry equations, not the equations of motion. So here's the sort of basic idea that turns out in this algebraic killing spinner game. So the first thing you do is you make an ansatz for the metric. Actually, you don't have to make so much of an ansatz for the fluxes. I'll talk about that in a minute. You just make an ansatz for the metric that you're looking for. Based on the physics, you know, you want a Coulomb branch, you want a certain amount of symmetry. So you look, you base your thing on the R symmetry and other global symmetries you may have, and the local location of your Brain Pro moduli space. As I say, I'll do an example of this soon and put flesh on the idea. You put in lots and lots of arbitrary functions. You can tolerate, well, I can tolerate up to about 10 or 12 of them. But basically, the kind of problem that would give the average relativist, you know, a screaming fit if you gave it to them, it would be unsolvable if you try to use Einstein's equations. But you can tolerate a lot of arbitrariness in this ansatz. Then, the key idea is you basically define the supersymmetry space by a family of projectors. And what I have to do is tell you where you're going to get these from. So you've got a bunch of projectors. You start with 32, and you just keep chucking in more projectors till you've reduced the supersymmetry to what you want. And the thing that characterizes all those solutions that you don't know how to solve, or we didn't know how to solve until now recently, is that all these turn out to be algebraic functions in the metric flux, the metric ansatz. So in other words, a priori, if you write down a delta psi, if you write down delta psi like this, there is a term, grad mu epsilon, and in here is a whole bunch of connection pieces. And these involve derivatives of the metric. And so a priori, when you solve this kind of equation equals zero, it reduces a set of projection conditions, but those projection conditions could involve derivatives of the metric. But it turns out every one of these things are algebraic, and that's what makes them special. That's why we call them algebraic killing spinners. So having defined the space, you haven't said how they depend on stuff, you just told them the directions. You've defined, if you like, the supersymmetry bundle. You can normalize everything, because you know those are killing vectors. So you've defined the space and the actual norms of everything in sight. And the reason why you don't really have to put an ansatz on the fluxes is that now, you, having done that, you look at these equations in a whole new light. You used to say these are horrible differential equations to solve. Now you say, no, we know this. These are algebraic equations in the fluxes. So now you've reduced the problem to one of algebra. You can determine every single one of the fluxes, having made the ansatz for the spinner. So you sort of turn the problem on its head by defining it to be easy. It's overdetermined, hugely overdetermined typically, but basically it's solvable, and it's algebraic. And then, of course, the Bianchi identities. You apply the Bianchi identities and you get a first order system, and that's what you get. So that's the basic idea. You define the spinners, nail them, and then you solve the equations rather straightforwardly. You don't have to solve any differential equations. So the whole thing boils down to, how do you figure out the projectors? And that's why I went into the sort of philosophy at the beginning. Okay, so there are two elements in this game. If you've got a Brain Probe moduli space, you use it. So if you've got a Brain Probe moduli space, if you've got a Coulomb branch in the field theory, this is when this pays off mightily. So basically what you do is the transverse coordinates of the brain of the probe on the moduli space have a supersymmetric sigma model. And if you had a supersymmetric sigma model, the probe metric on the moduli space is Kähler or hyperKähler or one of these special geometry, pieces of special geometry, but Kähler typically. So the bottom line is, there is, on the Brain Probe moduli space, special holonomy, S-U-N, sitting on the moduli space. So if you're looking for a reduced amount of supersymmetry, like 1 or 2, they've got to be on that moduli space, the singlets of the holonomy. So what's being said here is that through this space, there's a very, very nice slice. Get control of the spinners on the slice. You get control of the spinners by using the special holonomy on that bit. It's not everything, but you're not quite there. You're almost there. So, as I said, this is how you deal with special holonomy. You say on the moduli space, there are frames in which the supersymmetry is characterized in the way that you know and love from Green, Schwartz, and Witten, and before, in fact, way back, Candelas et al. of how compact final car be out. You just put in helicity projectors. I'll choose one helicity just to keep it simple, and you apply them on the spinners. And of course, the complex conjugates. Now, the whole question is, can you get that useful piece of information off the moduli space onto the whole space? Well, it's tempting to do the obvious thing, but there are choices here. I want to just simply say, this is my projector on the whole space, but I want a canonical way to do that, so that I've now reduced some of my supersymmetry. And there is a canonical way, and this is where a little bit of G-structures is very helpful. So, there's a whole philosophy here which I'm not going to do justice to. It is actually equivalent to the kind of approach we're using. But basically it says, once given a supersymmetric compactification, given a bunch of supersymmetries, you can form a whole bunch of sandwiches. Epsilon bar, gamma's epsilon, forms of this type. Moreover, in 2B, and in M theory this is all you've got, but in 2B you've got two choices. You can take the Dirac conjugate or you can take the Majorana conjugate. And in terms of the underlying R symmetry, this is R neutral and this is R charge 1. But anyway, there are lots and lots of forms. And because because the spinner satisfies a first order differential equation, these satisfy first order differential equations because you differentiate them. And you get a huge rat's nest on the right hand side, which you try and sort out. And you, in some cases, it sorts out beautifully. The other thing, if you're even more courageous, is you can show they satisfy algebraic equations. And those algebraic, and you have to start doing fits, rearrangements, and all sorts of terrible things. But in fact, for M theory, a lot of this is sorted out. In fact, there's a nice review paper, a couple of papers by Gauntlet on the subject. I may be missing other people's work, but this is the one I read to get what I needed. So the basic idea is, given supersymmetries, you've got forms. And the whole idea of G-structures is you attack this problem by asking, what are the differential equations and what are the algebraic interrelationships of forms? It's a nice approach and it's made some progress, but in a different class of problems. All I'm going to need here are these two guys, both Dirac conjugates. And I'm going to stick to M theory. As I said, the details haven't been worked out in 2B, but for this it's relatively straightforward. First of all, as I've already noted, this is always a killing vector. Now, this two form has a couple of very, very nice properties. Again, I'm in M theory. First of all, it squares almost to the identity. K mu is, of course, the K mu that you get from the single sandwich. So when you raise the indices, it is basically omega squared is K mu squared. This is usually a time-like killing vector. So when you square it, it's a warp factor times minus 1. And in fact, if it's a time-like killing vector, all this does is it says this projects you onto the space-like part of the metric. So it says you've got a tensor, if you've got a supersymmetry, just one supersymmetry, you have a tensor that squares to minus 1 up to a warp factor on the spatial section of the metric. Time-like, it doesn't have a component. And as I said, K mu can be arranged to be parallel to the brain. In 2B, it's either null. So you have to drop a couple of directions out of this, it turns out. But basically, on the spatial sections of the metric, plus a couple of directions, internal spatial directions, plus some of the brain directions, omega is an almost complex structure, or at least conformal to one. The thing that makes these class of solutions I'm going to talk about different from everybody else, the ones that have gone before, is most people then just say, oh, it must be here. There's a complex structure. It turns out that this identity critically uses some of the brain directions. It mixes brain directions with internal coordinates. It's also almost Kähler, not quite, because when you take D of it in M theory, you get this contraction of the killing vector. So the failure of Kählerness, if this is parallel to the brain, it only picks the components parallel to the brain, and so it's almost closed except for components that are parallel to the brain. But the important point is this: it's an almost complex structure on the internal plus some of the brain directions. And therefore, it is also the guy that becomes the Kähler form when you go to the brain probe moduli space. So the statement is that this thing, is the way that you extend the helicity basis of the Kähler moduli space on the brain probe moduli space onto the entire manifold, and therefore this makes canonical sense. I can define this globally. It doesn't have a nice, it's not closed, but I can do this as a definition using this complex structure. So I've defined for you how to take the projectors on the brain probe moduli space anywhere onto the manifold. Now, part two. The core of why this is different from previous cases is here. So the usual way you have, when you have D3 brains, you have a projector, and you use this to sort of sift the symmetries perpendicular to the brain. What you have to do is to deform this, and this is the deformation you have to use, and I'm going to try and motivate every bit of it. Bottom line is, it works, but I'm going to want to explain why, or try and explain what I think, why. This, by the way, we've now done 4 or 5 of these calculations, and this feature is always the same. So what we got? We've got basically the standard projector for the brain with some function. This is actually going to be allowed to be a function of position times the thing you first thought of, rotating into something else. So what really the guts of this thing is, here's the something else. So what is this something else? Well, it's got to be a projector, so it's going to satisfy a whole bunch of algebraic conditions. But basically, it's going to be a couple of gamma matrices, and they're going to be a pair of the internal indices, and the motivation is that because you're turning on B-field fluxes, you know you're getting some form of Myers effect, and therefore you should expect to see some dielectric NS and D5 brains in the solution. And the products of 6 gamma matrices, which is what this is, should be that physically motivated by that part of the projector. It is the thing that is going to tell you that you've got the dielectric stuff. So, the idea is you're going to find out what A and B are, roughly speaking, from BAB. Now, this is a heuristic rule, because there are bits of it that are going to be transverse to where you want to project. But the idea is, because you're turning this on, you're extending the projector into 2 more components. So the rule is that this is going to have 2 gamma matrices in it. That's also required for squaring it to 1. As I say, it's not a perfect dictionary, but it's a heuristic idea. We can actually make it more perfect in due course. Psi, the thing that does the rotation, is to be determined. It's another arbitrary function. This is all there just to take care of our symmetries. This star operation is you complex conjugate the spinner. As I said at the beginning, you write this in Poincaré in terms of the Poincaré metric. Your goal is to relate chi 1 to chi 2. So it turns out that relationship is being generated by this term, and so therefore you complex conjugate to make this the same kind of spinner as that. So that's just a technical device. But that messes up the R charge behavior. And phi, in the whole discussion, will always be the internal coordinate corresponding to the U1R symmetry. And there will be a killing vector internally, and so this phi, basically the spinners come with R charge minus a half, so when you hit its star, it gets plus a half, and this takes minus 1, and then feeds you back something with the right R charge. So this is just technical to get the R charge straight. Okay, now, that's the deformation of the canonical projector, and the thing that is remarkable about these solutions is, as I say, these functions that turn up in this projector are algebraic in the metric coefficients. So that's the difference, the key difference. There's a little, I've got time. One remark I want to make about symmetries, and then we'll get on to the example and see how it all works. Just a little comment about symmetry actions. I've already remarked on it, but let's just talk about more explicitly. Another key thing that you need to use as much as possible is whatever symmetries you've got, and it's useful to remember that if you've got symmetries, the R symmetries transform the supersymmetry, so there's some matrix that you know of charges, and other global symmetries that aren't R symmetries don't touch them, so this X is zero in those directions. And then there's a standard geometric realization. The lead derivative on spinners is well defined if this is a killing vector, and so you impose that the lead derivative on the spinner is given by this representation. This basically handles the behavior of the spinners in all the symmetry directions. And in particular, to put a little bit more detail on that previous e to the minus I phi in the projector, the killing vector in the direction of the U1R symmetry is just dd5, we choose the coordinate there, and it's in the conventions, I think minus a half is the charge. So, to figure out what this projector pi naught is, it's got to commute with all the symmetries, which is a huge constraint in itself. It's got to square to itself, which is another constraint. And another useful bookkeeping device is you require all the projectors to commute. If they don't commute, you get another projector, which you have to throw in the list, but you want to wind up with the target number of supersymmetries, 4 or 8, by the time you're done. So all of this, in a mathematical sense, completely fixes pi naught. There's not a lot of choice once you've pinned this down. So let me show you the example of how it works in practice and why it's both very simple and very complicated. Okay, so the results that are going to come out are the Coulomb branch of the least stress, the flow. So in other words, we've got an n equals 1 supersymmetric flow, 4 target supersymmetries. That means we've got to cut them in half three times, so three projectors, the deformation of the canonical projector and two more and coming from the brain probe moduli space, and that will do the job. So what do we got? We've got the mass here, which is the massive direction, phi 3, I'll talk about more about that in a minute, and there's the Coulomb branch. To make my life manageable, at least to get one step further, I'm not going to do the most general distribution of brains, it's still beyond this, but I'm going to do something that's one step better than has been done before. I'm going to allow the brains to spread in a radially symmetric manner. In other words, I'm going to let the density be an arbitrary function of V, where V is, morally speaking, the VEV that's running out on the Coulomb branch. So I'm going to allow them, I'm going to keep myself a nice SU2 global symmetry, otherwise it gets a bit too hairy. So the solution is going to be, it's better than previously. The previous known solutions, there was a two-parameter family. This is one arbitrary function of one variable. That's what we should get. And here's the sort of sketch of how the internal space, six dimensions, works. We're going to have a radial coordinate called V running out in the Coulomb branch direction. The coordinate U, which is parameterized in the sort of massive direction. The R symmetry actually also acts in a pair in that direction. And then I've got a bunch of Euler angles for the SU2 here, which I encode in the standard left invariant one forms. So here's the list of things that we have. Got some coordinates along the brain, a radial coordinate along the Coulomb branch with its Euler angles, that's where the moduli space is going to lie. There's going to be these transverse coordinates, and the phi is the R symmetry direction. And everything in sight is a function of two variables, U and V. You allow it to be a function in this direction, of course it'll have to be a function in the U direction as well. So it's not just one variable, functions of two. So as I said, you make an ansatz immediately for the metric, and you start. You're not shy about throwing in arbitrary functions to a certain degree. Here is an ansatz with six arbitrary functions. Everything in sight is a function of both variables, transverse to the moduli space and along the moduli space. A warp factor. Now here, I made some choices. There's a coordinate freedom to redefine this. So you use that coordinate freedom, any two-dimensional slice is conformal to flat space, so you make this the flat metric, and then you remember that phi is in fact the Killing direction, it's the R symmetry direction, so therefore I can choose those coordinates so that I can basically make that flat. And then I have to, having redefined U in that way, I have to get rid of the du dv cross terms in the metric, so that fixes the almost fixes the redefinition of V. So I fix my coordinate invariances by going there. And then I just put arbitrary functions in front of everything else in sight, and I even allow this to mix in a way. So I've got six arbitrary functions. We'll keep count of the arbitrary functions as we go. Another arbitrary function, you just do the obvious thing with respect to the four-form flux, it's the volume on the brain, but now it's a function of two variables, and then you just make it self-dual by fit. So here we are, frames. It's lurking here. Just written down now, I've probably got a peculiar historical labeling, but anyway, I'll explain. The ones to keep an eye on are A1 and A2. They're the scales in the U and V direction. U is the phi 3 or massive direction, this is the Coulomb branch direction. And there is an almost complex structure. The one that you knew you had to have has been basically built in because it's here, and it's here by construction, and the only other remaining place it is here. And of course, perhaps parallel in the brains. So, the pairings, 5, 8, and 6, 7, that's the sort of angular directions, that's the radial and the another angular direction aligned in the moduli space, and that's the transverse space. So all you do now, I'll put that one later, I think. I'll jump to the projectors and I'll come back to the other fluxes. So you follow your nose through this algorithm. The moduli space points in the 5, 6, 7, 8 direction. And you have to use the almost complex structure. So here, just take the plus signs. You impose the helicity requirements in the two complex directions on the moduli space and declare them to be global because you've got the global structure. This, on the moduli space, you have SU2 holonomy. What you're saying is that whatever you want is going to be SU2 holonomy singlets on that moduli space, and you extend it globally. Then, you take spinners with this, but now there's also the deformation. Now, why did I choose 6, 8? The answer is there's not a heck of a lot of choice. It's going to be a pair of internal coordinates. It's got to commute with these two guys. So basically, the only options is that it's got one of these and one of these. So you take what you can take 6 and 8 I've chosen, but because of these projectors, 6 is equivalent to choosing 7 and 8 is equivalent to choosing 5. So you take one of these and one of these, and because of the complex conjugation operation of the eye, that actually commutes. So there's not a lot of choice. The only other choice is if I take none of these, so it will be 4 and 9, but that doesn't commute with the symmetry action, so therefore basically that's the only thing you can do. It really is fixed for you. So as long as you accept there's only two, you only use two gamma matrices, you accept the dielectric brain interpretation. Okay, and then now you've defined the spinner space. The spinner space is defined by this. Having done this, you normalize everything. That fixes the U and V dependence of every spinner. The fact that this is a killing vector fixes everything. And now use the Lie derivatives to fix the angular dependence. And away you go. So what has happened as a result of all this is you have completely written down in closed form every spinner that is going to be a candidate supersymmetry. And it's written down in terms of two functions, psi, the one that sits here, and a naught. A naught snuck in because a naught is the warp factor in the direction the killing vector lies, and so the normalization is always expressed in some fractional power of a naught, exactly the same way it happens in the harmonic ansatz. It's sort of one quarter of whatever's out front of the metric. Now, these two fields, we have to finish the ansatz for these, has U and R charge plus 1, so in fact you just get the phase dependence immediately. Now, this is the guy that's driving the fermion mass term, and so its perturbative form is fixed. You can immediately read off what that is. Now you've got to go for the global form. There are two ways of doing this. There's the one that's a huge amount of hard work and you get bogged down. To be honest, we only solved it in general in M theory. It turns out in 2B it's a little bit harder. You just stick in, Dennis wants to see one of these with 72 arbitrary functions in it and actually got to the end. Once you've got the spinners, this is so constrained that you can actually check this out. But in fact, what you can do is you can also make a shortcut, use the perturbative form of the known perturbative form and the known solution. And you realize that within the almost complex structure, A mu nu has a gauge in which it is in fact 2-0. Just happens. It also comes out of the calculation if you try hard enough. So in fact, here it is. The general ansatz for A will be, here are the complex pairs on the internal space. This one has to come out as a factor because this is the one in the SU2 direction. It has to pair up nicely to get the R symmetry and the U1's global symmetry is right. So that has to be a factor. But other than that, these can appear with arbitrary functions. So here's two more arbitrary functions. So here's the list of arbitrary functions. 6 metric functions, 1 for the C4 field, 1 for the B2 for the B2s, and one more to come. I reordered the transparencies, psi, the rotation. So we have 10 arbitrary functions at this point. As I say, the average relativist would probably be gibbering. Well, seriously, if you try to put this into Einstein equations, it would be hopeless, utterly hopeless. But what you do is you solve the supersymmetry equations. So you need to be intelligent about this. If you just put it in a computer, you just get a terrible mess. There are tricks that you can do, the first of which is there's always combinations which have very few or none of the fluxes. And they immediately give you things like, there are no fluxes, in fact, in this variation of this problem, direct relationships, algebraic relationships between the metric coefficients. So here's two functions immediately fixed. Spin half variation tells you nothing. It's just the same as one of the moduli space projectors. And then you basically go through looking or picking off the easy components. You've got thousands to choose from, and some of them are really ridiculously simple. So that's two functions dead. And look here, what you also find is that, this is very important. Here it is. This is the thing that's in the pi naught. And here it is, algebraically determined in terms of metric coefficient functions. Nothing else. It always seems to turn out like that. But this is back to front. The way we discovered this algorithm was essentially by finding this in the example. Then you just grind through algebraic equations everywhere in sight. W, but it turns out you can integrate a whole bunch of them. And so here, this is the four-form flux, and this is the two-form flux expressed in terms of everything. And now we're down from 10 to 4 functions without any work. Well, not with about 2 or 3 hours of work. Then it gets hard. I'm not going to be shy about this. It gets very complicated at this point. But you can usually sift through it, and here's the answer that you wind up with. So, define G1 A1 minus A2. I'll say more about the physics of this in a minute. Then it turns out that when your dust settles, it has to satisfy this equation. It's not linear. That's the nasty thing. I'll say more about that in a minute. But it is a second order PDE. And it turns out that once you have got the solution to this, it generates everything. It generates all the solutions to supersymmetries, and you can check it solves all the equations of motion. So this is the analog of the five-dimensional supergravity equation. You knew that it had to be a PDE, and you knew it had to have something that looked like the harmonic PDE. After all, you're after the Coulomb branch. The only pain is it's nonlinear. But it's basically morally the analog of it's the generalization of harmonic ansatz. And once you've got this thing, you generate the whole beastly flow. Basically, you find that there's an auxiliary function you need, which says, if you look at this equation and think of it as an integrability condition, you take ddv of this side and put it to ddu of that side, it reproduces that equation. So this equation is the integrability condition for a function f. Put another way, if you've got a solution, you get f by quadrature, and then the only undetermined functions we had before were this list. Well, you've got f, you've got g from the differential equation, you've now got f. You get the angle of rotation by differentiating f. You get a naught, the overall warp factor in front of the brain, by differentiating g and put it throwing in the angle. A5 is then determined by differentiating g. And g, remember, was this difference. And so to get them independently, you need one more equation. And so you get this from this. Again, largely algebraic or simple first-order differentiation. But let me stress, this differential equation contains all the information about the solution. The solution to that differential equation generates the entire supersymmetry, and it also solves Einstein's equations. Oh, I'll come to that in a minute. Next, transparency. Yes. Boundary conditions. So this is the thing that drives everybody. You've just solved that DE. But remember what this thing was. Yeah. Turned out to be. We'd fixed the U and V invariants, and basically it's the thing that turns up e to the 2a1 times du squared. And remember, that's the massive direction. That's the direction where the phi 3s are, plus e to the 2a2 dv squared. That's the radial direction where the other coordinates are, phi 1 and phi 2. So that's the Coulomb branch direction. And basically, because of this, you want flat space and infinity. You want those coefficients, or at least you want an overall warp factor. So the ratio of those coefficients is going to go to zero. So the boundary condition is easy. It's zero at infinity. If you want asymptotic ADS, you want something else, you mess with this. But you get it from the asymptotics. Now, it looks like a nasty DE, so you don't look happy. U and V. So there's one U, which is the in the massive direction, the phi 3 direction, so that goes out to infinity. And then there's also the way you go out to infinity on the Coulomb branch. There are two directions now in this problem. It's not just one simple radial coordinate. In physics terms, there are two scales in the problem. There's the overall radius, which is the RG scale, and then there's the mass scale of the fermion. The mass scale of the fermion is, in fact, exactly this. The ratio of the Coulomb branch scale to the scale in the phi 3 direction is the mass scale over the Coulomb branch scale. So this function has a real physical meaning. It's what I wanted. It is the guy which is expressing the only scale invariant combination of scales in the problem, which is the mass scale of the fermion and the mass scale over the Coulomb branch scale. And one thing that's nice about it is I want to convince you that I've got one arbitrary function in this, is it has a very, very simple perturbation theory. So since it goes to zero, you can expand in small variables, and it linearizes to something very nice. It just basically take 2h out of there, cancel the 2, and there's the linearized equation. So a first order, asymptotically, you have a linear equation to solve. That's the harmonic ansatz. And then, if you just simply stick this into there and collect powers, you find that the equation of every order you have to solve is a linear equation sourced by the polynomials and lower order h's, going from that exponential. And so the idea is that the whole thing is generated by a single seed function, which is solved by a linear PDE of second order. Weak coupling, if you like, but the bottom line is, if you want to solve this, there's related to this is an underlying source function, and you can choose that source function to be an arbitrary density distribution in V located at U equals zero. So there's exactly the choices I advertise in solving this problem. So it's not that I haven't solved the problem, but I've shown you that the single differential equation I've got is exactly characterizing what I hoped it would at the beginning, which is an arbitrary density distribution in V. And in principle, you can sum this up. Of course, at every step in the game, you have to worry about adding more solutions to the homogeneous equation, but it's a standard procedure in math. But what I wanted to do is sort of come back to this physics point about what it is I've got here. As I say, it's generated, the entire solution is thus generated by a single source function, exactly as I advertised it would be. Whether this is truly the source function, remember it's the source function for the linearized problem, and then you feed it in. Whether it's truly the source, you can't tell. You have to go asymptotically into the middle. But the function that's making all of this go, the thing that's making it all work, is this difference. And this difference is the scale in this direction compared to the scale in that direction. And as much as we can make correct holographic identifications of stuff, this is the scale in the massive directions compared to the scale in the Coulomb directions. It's m over phi. So it's, in fact, exactly what you want it to be. Now, lest you think this is a freak of the particular problem I've chosen, here are four other examples of exactly the same phenomenon. So this is the one we just talked about. But it turns out that every other class that we've analyzed so far falls into this thing. There's an n-theory analog, so it's kind of cheating. It's almost exactly the same equation, except the degrees in V have changed. And the reason why the degrees in V have changed is the moduli space is six-dimensional rather than four. So the powers are just, I don't know if there's a rationale to go beyond that. It's exactly the same equation. But 6 months ago, we also had the Denali-Winton flows. And here is the master equation. The same conclusions are true. This is the fermion mass on the money. And you have to solve this GE. Now, it looks different. This is e to the g and this is g. This is just an artifact. Call g e to the h, or e to the h, or e to the 2h or something. Then write this, and then factor out the overall factor of e to the h on the other side, and you'll get an equation of exactly the same form. So this equation is nonlinear, but it's exactly the same form as that. And here's the n-theory analog again, very similar to this. But basically, there always seems to be one fundamental differential equation. It has good perturbation theory, and it is, in fact, the scale.
Are intersecting in five brains in this class?
No. So when you do this game, the M2 brain dielectrically polarizes into a gas that still contains... The M5 brain lies exactly parallel to the M2 brain. The M2 brain is completely inside the M5 brain. So it's like from infinity you see M2 brains, but when you get close, you see that M2 brain is now a dielectric gas of M5 brains, and anti-M5 brains.
I think using M5 brains also give you a nonlinear equation in two variables, like this.
But that doesn't have good perturbation theory.
Does that have good perturbation theory?
The perturbation theory is second order and blows up if you put down the natural sources.
Yeah, it's the perturbation theory I'm also doing here is from infinity, so I'm not sure how good or bad it'll be. There's one useful trick that I found with this, which is kind of cute, is that if you say, I want to look at what happens near u equals 0, this equation drops into something incredibly trivial. And that gives you then, when you put it back in, it gives you a Gucci-Hansen or something like, or some variant of a Gucci-Hansen space. So if you're interested in the geometry of the moduli space, you actually can read it off, because the moduli space at u equals 0, and you make some assumptions about first derivatives, and you can actually get information about what the moduli space has to look like rather directly. So this one of the solutions to this is a Gucci-Hansen, if you'll do it right. So there's one other thing. Oh yeah, one other comment. I didn't put it here. There's a fifth one of these, which Yosef Benyon and I are just finishing up at the moment. It's not a massive flow. It's a weird one that we thought we'd analyze this because it was there in that sort of Hilary-esque kind of way. It's got 16 supersymmetries, but it's not what you think it is. It is, in fact, M2 brains dielectrically posing into a gas of M5 and anti-M5s at 90 degrees. It has 16 supersymmetries. This equation becomes out to be linear. It is just, in fact, exactly the Laplacian on R8. But it generates a huge complicated solution. It has no mass in it. It's still 16 supersymmetries. But it's an interesting freak that we don't understand, but we thought we'd better look at it there. Okay, so final comments. Bottom line of this whole procedure is that you are looking for very, very complicated families of solutions when you write them down, they look like hell. But in fact, underlying this whole thing, is a very, well, relatively simple, single PDE that generates everything. It generalizes the harmonic rule, because that's what the harmonic rule is. Solve the differential equation, and everything is determined from the differential equation. It also generalizes the results from supergravity. Now remember, the supergravity equations of motion were simple steepest descent equations, which generate a very complicated solution. The thing that's driving it, this difference, is in the known solutions, it is in fact holographic dual to the fermion mass on the mummy. It's log of C in the old language. It's incredibly straightforward, well, that you just read it off. But more generally, what you're looking at is it's the mass scale of whatever you're running compared to the Coulomb scale. As I've just shown you, there are other classes of this flow governed by other rather similar PDEs. So if anybody knows how to solve these PDEs, I'd like to know. As I say, that PDE is where the essential physics has to lie. It's not, the solution itself is useful, but I don't imagine it's going to be easy to analyze or write down the metrics. But this PDE is actually got the guts of it. Let's see. Oh, yeah. Now, more general morals and messages. The useful idea in the Myers effect is when you turn on the B fields, it sort of adds yet another brain, which then proceeds to cut your supersymmetry more. What's happening here is that really the B fields aren't breaking the symmetry more in some sense. They are just dielectrically polarizing the pi naught. They are not. There's this rotation that's going on the pi naught that says, hey, I was D3 brains, but now I've got a bit that's D5 brains, and there's a functional relationship between the two. And this is the sort of very much the new element that's turned up in these solutions. And that's why they didn't fit into anybody's classification scheme before. As I say, the solution technique, once you realize that, is not much more than what we knew before. Once you realize you've got to throw that projector in, you've basically, this whole idea of algebraic killing spinners is really simply a hybrid of taking special holonomy and adding that projector. What you've done is you've salvaged what you have left of special holonomy. You have a moduli space, you write down the holonomy on that moduli space, and then you extend it to the whole space. And the surprising thing is that when you're done, the projectors are still extremely tame. They are algebraic in metric coefficients. And it's a relatively effective computational tool. But as I say, the sort of new message in general for strings and brains and so on is that there's a new, very important, these are physically motivated supersymmetric backgrounds. They come from flows of field theories, and interesting flows of field theories, and they require that you think about dielectrically deforming that projector in a particular way. I'll stop there. It gets tougher and tougher. I mean, we started trying to do, there were many options we could do. We tried to actually add a few more variables. It gets really kind of complicated at that point. What we did was we put our energies more into looking at the other case, which is n equals 1, just to see whether the whole algorithm, you know, the thing that sort of started us on the whole process was that, you know, n equals 2 is 8 supersymmetries. If anything's going to be easy, it's going to be that one. And so the issue was then, having done that one, an accident. Was an accident of a huge amount of supersymmetry, or does the same algorithm work when there's less supersymmetry? So we did this. We started trying to do something more complicated. In principle, it's possible. In practice, I'm understating perhaps the level of work required. Remember the point where I said once you've done the 6 functions, the 4 get hard? It does get hard. You have to really go through them. You know, I do it in Mathematica, but you have to really go sift heavily into a Mathematica file to find the simple relationships. And I hope in this case it will, because the physics is exactly that. The physics is Coulomb branch plus a mass. And so I hope that there's just one PDE and then everything else should follow, because that's what the physics is telling me should be the case. PDE more variables. In particular, you know, the V variable will increase. Now, one thing that gives me a little disquiet is that remember I had to use that integrability condition to get the same auxiliary function F? It's hard to imagine how that generalizes to more variables. In the case with n equals 2 flows, 8 supersymmetries, there's no such thing. There's no integrability condition you have to use. It's just algebraic. And so that, I can see, could generalize easily to more variables. This one, I don't know exactly how it's going to happen. But the interesting thing is, this case is the one case where it might be actually relatively easy to generalize to 3 variables. Because if you think what's going on, there's a massive direction, which is u. And I said there's phi1 and phi2 directions. If you turn off the masses, what you have is the rotating brain solutions where there's an angular momentum in that direction, angular momentum in that direction. So there are actually 2 natural radial coordinates you can imagine introducing. So I think going to 3 variables here is going to be easy. Doing it in general, I don't know. The one I'm intrigued by is the one Josef and I did, more for the mathematics of it, because the equation you get at the end is the Laplace equation. It is exactly the Laplace equation on R8. And yet it's got full of complicated fluxes, it's dielectrically polarized N5. So I'm going to use that one as a way to try and understand how to exactly go in the direction you're asking, try and figure out what the underlying, how far you can go and how many variables.
Is there any prospect for compact solutions? I mean, one reason there might not be is because it all those you have some amount of symmetry, you reduce the number of variables, and compact solutions generally have no symmetry. Realistic ones generally have no symmetry.
I guess one of the messages I'd say for the people trying to do compact solutions is I would say you've got to pay attention to this.
Because the Becker solutions have this nice property that you can immediately, the compact, non-compact, it's all the same.
Right.
But they're just about the only ones that seem to sort of.
You can flip from one to the other easily. Well, the imaginary self-dual things and so forth, those are
right,
exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
Oh, I see, okay. Yeah, I haven't haven't thought through whether you can do this. In fact, what we're actually working on fairly extensively at the moment is to try and look at the n equals 2 quiver flows and see whether we can do something with those, get Klebanov-Witten and all those other ones explicitly using this kind of game. Compact ones.
More, I don't know if there are any of the flow type solutions, which where you perturb the ADS and affinity.
Right.
Can be fit
into a compact space.
No,
to be honest, I don't, because the whole starting point is you start with a non-normalizable mode,
right.
You turn it on, and it's kind of hard to figure out how to push that in. But I would say I would emphasize that this is the point that's for the compactifications. If you want to go for new classes of compactifications,
mm-hmm.
You turn on B fields. You have to go beyond that usual, oh, here's the brain projector, boom, and away you go. There's another fact that comes out as a consequence of this, which is where I think I mentioned it, but let me just make a comment that one other reason why you, if you remember I sort of said, when you take omega squared, it's sort of like, well, I'll throw away the normalization, but it's the identity on the spatial metric. And the usual leap is to say, oh, well, the spatial metric is the internal metric, and it's an almost complex structure, almost minus the identity. It's not. This is usually a couple of brain directions thrown in, plus internals. So the natural complex structure lurking in all these solutions is, in fact, brain plus internal. And these are, roughly speaking, the two directions of the D3 brain that have been polarized into the extra directions in the 5 brain. So, in fact, there is, in M-theory, a 10-dimensional almost complex structure, 2 brain directions and 1 and all the internals, and in 2B there is an 8-dimensional almost complex structure, 2 brain directions.
So even with an odd-dimensional complex space, you might have a useful complex structure.
Yes, because what happens is it's the spatial section. You throw away the time. It's that projector, and in this, in the 2B case, the projector you have here is actually a null vector, and it's in fact the null and its dual, I think. So you throw away 2 directions, and you get an 8-dimensional space, and that. But the point is that this message here about deforming this. Is also a message about how you think about the complex structure in compactifications. You may need to incorporate the spatial sections of the brain as well. That's, I think, the only message I can really say for real compactification.
Since you're taking something like this, a perturbative approach,
mm-hmm.
Do you happen to know what happens to the solution when you get far from infinity?
Far from. Okay, one thing you can do is you can. In this case, because I've only got 2 variables, it doesn't give you a huge amount of information. But you can ask yourself, well, I've got a moduli space. I can set U equals 0. And I can say, let's look at the metric. Now, if the metric is nice, it's going to be even function about the moduli space. So therefore, in the U direction, it's going to be reflection symmetric. So therefore, first derivatives are going to vanish. So I can use the fact that the metric functions in the first derivatives in the U direction vanish. And I can say, okay, well, let's just suppose the second derivative has vanished as well. I ask, what does that equation tell me? And it gives me an equation in one variable for the metric dependence on the actual moduli space. And as I say, if you do this in the M theory example, where you have two, you get a Gucci-Hansen, or you get a product of a Gucci-Hansen. I'd say that in the core of the solution, if you had more variables and you did this, you would actually get the metric on the moduli space on the money.
But if you looked at the
equation in Sorry? No, I haven't looked at it. No, it's I could put it in principle, but it's it would certainly be interesting to try. But I've, as I say, this is not even off the press quite yet. It's last stuff, but that's maybe a good problem for a graduate student to see what's there. I'd rather like to try and get one more variable in it, so I can do exactly what you're asking about, which is look at the core and see if I can see how the moduli space shapes from the differential equation. Yeah, that's the kind of thing I'd like to do. I'd also like to try and do the problem that the demon originally whispered to me, which is trying to get it for the 2B with an arbitrary radial and angular dependence on the brain. So I can actually lay out brains and actually try and recover the Dynagy-Witten effective action at large M.